And we are burning down the house. Here every Thursday at 8 Eastern Time on heritageradionetwork.com. A continuing conversation about the culture of architecture and design, in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, passions, and ideas that inform and direct the creation of our environment. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. This evening's program is brought to you by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer on West 23rd Street in Manhattan. You should check it out. Did you know that they have a pro audio department? It's a very cool place. They also have high def monitors. Great selection. This evening in studio, joining us in conversation are a couple of writers, a designer. The designer, Manuel Saez. Did I pronounce it correctly?
Yes.
Okay. The writer, Michael Cannell. He is frequently seen with a byline on the New York Times. He's a writer for Fast Company. He is also the author of several very interesting blogs. The Design Vote, The House Vote, the Kitchen Vote,
The Room Vote.
The Room Vote. Come a little closer.
And the Gadget Vote.
If you could point your microphone a little more closely towards your mouth, then we can hear you so much better. And as our guest interlocutor, representing the voice of the people, Vox Populi, Jamie M. Waugh, who's joined us before. Jamie's also a writer for Dwell and a freelance advertising copy writer. Is that correct?
That's right.
So what brings us all together is not necessarily environments, but the things that furnish the environments, well-designed objects. Now, Manuel, you're a chair designer. Mies van der Rohe, the famous German architect, said that a chair is the most difficult thing in the world to design. That's why Chippendale is famous.
Yeah. And he's right. I mean, there's so many chairs. There have been chairs since we sat on a rock. So it's
Come a little closer.
It's pretty. Pretty hard to top that, right? I mean, there are so many ways of
sitting.
Know. Yeah.
You were just looking at a chair here in the studio that's repurposed from a backrest.
So yeah, it was. I was actually sitting on the backrest, turned around, and with four legs on it, and it was a chair. It wasn't comfortable though, but it was.
No, but it's a chair for perching on. That's latecomers have to sit on that one.
It looks good, though.
Now, your work has been for some really high-end corporate contract furnishings places. Tell us about that a little bit.
I worked for about 6 years as design director at a company called HumanScale. And HumanScale is the world's largest manufacturer of ergonomic products
for the office. I'm a big fan of HumanScale. I have a Niels Different Freedom Chair.
Yeah, absolutely.
In my studio.
You got the best.
And a HumanScale keyboard rest.
Yeah.
So I'm big fans of them. You also worked with Geiger International, which is...
Yeah, correct. Geiger is a subsidiary of Herman Miller. And what they do, they focus on wood and wood cases and private offices. So it will be the higher end of the spectrum on the market for the office furniture.
Now, interested lay people who are listening to this program will know Herman Miller probably most famously is the people who manufacture the Eames chair.
The Eames light, yes.
And all those George Nelson products and things like that. Now, Michael, in your blogging about fabulous and good design objects, where do you find all this stuff? You must be having to troll constantly, looking for interesting, new, beautiful things to put up for the voting on your
Well, books. I am. I'm constantly looking. It actually isn't as hard to find things as you might think, because all of a sudden we live in a world of 1,000 design blogs, and every amateur designer and everybody who has an passing interest in design, it seems, has started a design blog, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them out there, and hundreds of people who are expressing themselves and expressing their tastes in this new medium. And I look at a great deal of them, you know, needless to say, I don't always like what I see. It's a question, of course, for, you know, for anybody like me of looking at everything. I mean, you start at that point by looking at everything and then curating. You know, it's a curatorial exercise.
Yeah, but to what end? Is your reason for doing this because you want to spread the word about good design? Obviously, it's important to you because you write about design.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I used to work at Dwell, and Jamie has worked there as well. One thing about Dwell that never made me comfortable is that Dwell thought of itself as a cause. And I come from a reporting background. I used to work at the New York Times. And so I have a kind of opposite orientation. I see myself as a journalist. And so I'm not really, I don't think of these websites that I'm doing as being related to a cause at all. I'm not, you know, I'm really more interested in observing what's out there and kind of gauging the dynamics and the fashion of design more than trying to promote anything.
So you're doing it because you're interested and you want to share what you've found out, as any good reporter would want to do?
Yeah, I mean, I just to kind of back up for a second, if I may, I back-ended into this design vote project in a funny way. I was working on the Dwell website where I was surrounded by very, very smart 26-year-olds who knew a lot more about the internet than I did and sat through meetings in which I basically didn't understand a word they said. And I wanted to start a design website of my own, in part so that I could just understand how websites work. And also, you know, for those of us who have worked in the editorial side of design, you know, there's a thing that happens where, you know, PR people will send you images of new products. They get put into blogs or magazines. They are often described as being the next, you know, classic, the next great design. And, you know, I've often kind of wondered about the end recipients of all of that, the public. You know, do they really believe that? You know, so I started these voting blogs in part to see what people really thought about design, you know, to let people express for themselves what, you know, their reaction to designs that are, I think, too often kind of, you know, forced down their throats.
I noticed that you don't get a lot of, it seemed to me, looking at a couple of your blogs, you don't get a lot of people writing in with comments. It must be frustrating. You know, they vote up and down, but do you get some good commentary that might lead to something fuller, greater, maybe in an article?
I've thought about that a lot. I don't get a lot of comments, and I don't know whether that's a flaw in the design of the my websites. I mean, it might be possible that people want to, you know, they want to describe their reactions, but the websites are for some reason not facilitating that.
We'll leave it to our listeners. TheDesignVote.com, is it .com?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can have a look and see for yourselves if it seems pretty obvious where you should click to make a comment or not. You can speak anytime you like.
I actually had a question for Michael.
Please.
I checked your site, and it was a lot of fun, by the way, just voting and going through the products and choosing. And I wasn't driven to do the... Just write comments.
Uh-huh. Someone's cell phone is going off.
Maybe
I have to shoot it.
But my question is, how do you pick which products will be like somewhat competing against each other, because you pair them up?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. As I said earlier, I look at an awful lot of candidates, and I do try to select products and designs that I think are good designs. I tried to weed out the dreck. But I also, in the back of my mind, I have the idea that, you know, I want to select products that will elicit strong reactions from people.
Yeah.
You know, as you know, so many designs today are just further iterations of designs that you saw last month or last year. If you go to, you know, the big design shows, as you know, like ICFF, I mean, you know, you see the same stuff over and over and over again. So I'm not picking those things. I'm trying to pick things that are somehow, you know, whether you like it or not, they're at least kind of original new ideas.
Yeah, because what I thought is, if you have even the ones that do not get voted the most, they might still be good, but when you have a comparison, you know, when you put it in context with the other design that might be better for something else, it just felt like uneven the...
You're talking about posting two images together. I hadn't really thought of that. Yeah. I've always put up one thing and let people, do a thumbs up or thumbs down. That's an interesting idea. Yeah.
So have you heard from product designers who have been featured on your site who have seen an increase in sales after they've been voted?
You know, I haven't. Nobody's ever given me that kind of feedback. That's an interesting question. I mean, I can't imagine that I'm doing very much for their, you know, for their sales, because the websites, I think, are pretty well known at design circles at this point, but do not have an enormous circulation. I do include links so that people can click through and buy something if they want to, but I have no idea if it's really...
Is your site monetized? Affecting. Do you get any money for that?
Very little.
But you get a little bit of something.
Little bit. I mean, there's advertising. There's advertising on it, yeah.
Sure. Let's take a brief break, and when we come back, I want to talk about whether good design is really raising the level of happiness in the world. Burning Down the House, here every Thursday on heritageradionetwork.com. Burning Down the House is brought to you by TechServe, the number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer. Joining us this evening are Manuel Saez, who designs beautiful objects, Michael Cannell, who writes about beautiful objects, and the still silent Jamie Waugh here representing the voice of the people. I know you have questions for them. Just let's throw some of those questions out, and then we'll get around to whether good design really does raise the level of happiness in the world, or are people visually dead?
Actually, I have a point to make there.
Please.
I have an example of how good design makes people angry. in the world. Which
good design makes people angry?
Yeah, yeah. Basically, Michael earlier was talking about...
You're not talking about the time that my Pontiac Solstice got keyed because it was too beautiful and a drunken person staggered by on a Manhattan street.
No, not that time. But Michael was talking about starting the design vote, and one of the things that really made him inspired to start this was seeing how design journalism traditionally works. And you have a handful of people receiving a lot of press releases. All of the people involved are lovely people who work very hard, but at the end of the day, we're all machines. We're all trying to be more efficient. And so you have a bunch of journalists who have
speak
a bunch
for
of friends.
Yourself. I'm working on being inefficient.
We're all working on that right now. But you end up with, you know, working in a magazine where you're featuring a lot of products and design by a lot of the same people who are friends with the same people you work with or from the same PR company, clients of the same PR company. And then you talk to people who are unconnected to those circles geographically or socially, you know, people who live in other places or whatever. And these people, suddenly you realize this is a very insular world.
Well, where does the anger come in?
When my mom reads House and Garden magazine and she has somebody telling her that she needs to have a couch that doesn't have anything to do with her living room in Kentucky. That couch might be a very well-designed couch, but you have someone in an ivory tower talking about how this is a panacea for bad design. And so,
or an ivory cubicle.
Yeah, right. So Michael's talking.
So people actually take offense at a magazine waxing poetic about an $8,000 sofa?
For example.
Huh. Well, I think you hit it on the point. I mean, this is my take on great design, good design, and bad design. I think there's not such a thing as great, bad, or mediocre design. It's just everything is related to the context. So you have to understand where that thing is going. And then you can actually make a good judgment and say, well, is that good or bad? Or is that great design or not?
Right.
So, do you think
it takes a certain amount of education that people don't have generally in the world?
I think sometimes there's things that are aesthetically pleasing just because they look good or they have certain things that are either new or they have...
Irrespective of the culture of the person who's viewing this.
Yeah, I mean, in general population, you can say that there are certain things that are good looking, and yeah, there's way to manage that. There are certain aspect radius, there are certain colors, there are certain combination, harmony, balance, etc. You can actually manipulate beauty. Yeah, but you still need to put that in context in order to qualify it as a great design.
Have you? Well, I noticed from your website you have an office in China also.
Correct.
I'm remembering this story. Of early on in the China experience of having manufacturing done there, where a shoe designer mm-hmm. placed an order for several thousand shoes, and he wanted them to come with I think they were bamboo shoes, actually, and he wanted them in natural pale color. And when they were delivered, they were all purple, and mm-hmm. he, you know, sent off a telex saying, "What's with the purple?" And they said, "It's prettier." But purple wasn't the color in the West that year. But for the Chinese, from their point of view, purple was a more beautiful color than just plain bamboo. Do you run into that your work?
I think that's more of a quality control and communication issue than...
No, but you're talking about design tastes being
absolutely
perhaps universal.
Absolutely. I think there are certain things that are universal. There are certain things that are geographically or culturally more appealing. And that's definitely, to me, is a fact. So
give us some examples.
I don't know. For example, I would say the iPod. We, you know, like, let's use the iPod, like everybody talks about, as a design example. I think the iPod is appealing pretty much everywhere because it has a general look. Proportions are pretty good, pretty well done.
Yes,
everything is pretty balanced. Everything is
it has
harmonious.
Proportions of a Western playing card deck, pretty much.
It's pretty on the money on everything. So I think that in China that is a big hit. Same with the iPhone, they're also big hits. However, there are other products that could not get into the Chinese market. Furniture, for example, there's a lot of furniture that is from the West that would not fit in there. just because people don't find it appealing.
The spaces are too small.
China has big spaces. China doesn't have a challenge on spaces, but it's just the aesthetic appealing of certain furniture is just not fitting in there.
Well, what about marketing, though? How much does marketing play?
I think marketing plays a big role because, and this is just my take on experiencing the Chinese culture, everything that comes from the Western world and it has a brand associated with it is already approved to a level to be into the mainstream. Yet you still have to deliver and you still have to be within the price range.
Is that partially because it's electronics? I mean,
no, but
is electronics kind of easier to translate to another culture than a living room, you know, a poof would be?
Yeah, but also cars. I mean, cars
would be. A poof for the listeners who did not attend design school is a is a circular sofa with something you can lean on in the center. It was very elegant in the 19th century. You hardly ever see them. But it's nice to know that they exist.
I just like saying the word poof.
Poof, yes. Yeah. Poof. The last poof I saw was in one of the galleries at the Renwick Gallery in Washington. They're rather rare. But they might make a comeback in China, where they have big spaces.
And they're going to be red with a lot of chrome.
Red is good feng shui luck.
And maybe some
like money, yes.
Red stained wood.
Well, I sympathize with Jamie's mother. I think there is a lot of stuff in design magazines that puts people off. And what I think it would be a very interesting exercise to go back and look at design magazines from a year ago or 2 years ago and see how they look now, you know, because our world has changed so much in the last year.
I do that all the time.
And does it look, I mean, I wonder if you know, I mean, Architectural Digest is always over the top. That wouldn't be a good example. But I wonder if a lot of the design, you know, what seemed kind of exciting and fun and aspirational 2 years ago might seem sort of verging on offensive now because you know, we live in a different world and we are a more pared down, practical world now.
I can't really remember what was a really cool object that I might have wanted to have in my house 2 years ago. I mean, the I'm so stuck in the past that I still look at magazines from the late 1940s and early 1950s, and I want to live in that period of time again. Mm-hmm. I want to have the chrome and aqua kitchen equipment. Of course, that's been brought back into production now. You can have a totally brand new, technologically superior 1955 kitchen, if you so desire, which is, well, it's interesting. You know, in terms of design, it's regressive. I don't think it's just even retro. I think it's just regressive because it doesn't take that aesthetic and move it any further. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's a reinterpretation of an old look. And when you apply that to new manufacturing techniques and new technologies, I think that might be the novelty.
Yeah.
However, I think that what is successful that is brought from the past into the future or to the present are the things that are somewhat become a classic, or they have some sort of those things that we were talking about, imbalance in proportions, and the overall aesthetic are appealing a certain way.
Do you believe in the golden mean?
Absolutely. I think it's
that's
very,
a proportion that is related to the Fibonacci series of 1, 3, 5, 8, 13.
And it works.
And it's
8.5 by 11 sheet of paper too, right?
Not quite.
Sure.
No. A2 paper, the European paper.
The European paper.
Has a golden mean of 3 to 5.
And they say Denzel Washington's face also is an example of golden mean.
No, if you look at the face of the iPod, it's like that. If you look at an IMS chair, mm-hmm. it has those proportions. Mm-hmm. If you look at the overall body, you know, top to height, it's mm-hmm. 0.66 of the height.
So do you think that plays a part in what makes a piece a classic, what makes something live?
I think there are hidden things that I personally don't understand why they work, but they work, and you can use them.
And do you use them in your work?
I try to work in
the...
I try. So sometimes they don't quite fit for many things. They don't fit, but It's not just that. No, I mean, it's not that like, I got to get hung up on the Fibonacci, but it's more about balance. It's about symmetry. It's about rhythm and other things that complement that. And you can create and manipulate beauty with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, notwithstanding Jamie's mother in Kentucky who has sofa lust after she reads Dwell, do you think that good design does raise the level of happiness in the world? Case in point, I happen to like the new newsstands in Manhattan. It's a British designer. I understand that they, for those of you who haven't been to New York, they're stainless steel with glass. They're very clean. They're minimal. They're modern. They've got nice proportions. They have ways of integrating all of the different aspects that different newsstands in New York might want. Some newsstands have refrigerated sections where they have cold drinks. Others don't. There's a whole system of display racks that can be fitted into the same basic design. And some people hate that design. To me, that raises the level of civility and the pleasure of walking along the street. Also, the bus stop mm-hmm. shelters from the same design firm. Now, when it comes to your own work, or the work, Mike, that you're reviewing and reporting on, do you think that it makes for a better environment for the people who are using these spaces?
Well, for those of your listeners who do not know the website, aparttherapy.com, they should go take a look at it because it's one of the really, really good design-related websites on the internet. It was started by a gentleman named Maxwell Gillingham Ryan, who is a former teacher and started a design practice called Apartment Therapy, I believe. And it was really kind of that. It was design and therapy. And his theory has been that if you don't get your home right, you're not going to get the rest of your life right. His idea was, you know, we all need to create environments for ourselves that feel right, that are right for us, that are expressions of who we are. And if we don't, you know, if we don't do that, then, you know, the rest of our lives will somehow be out of sync. There's a sort of slightly feng shui.
Oh, it's very feng shui
idea there. But, you know, it's, I mean, I do, I think that's true. It's true probably for the home, but it's probably true for the public realm as well. You know, here in New York, Mayor Bloomberg is facilitating a lot of improved public spaces, you know, the closing off and containment of traffic versus pedestrian space.
That's where Broadway's been closed between Times Square and Herald Square.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you have to believe that that will change the civic mood in some way, if only subtly.
I'm not sure. I don't know. But that's public space. I'm more interested today to focus on the objects. Manuel, do you have chairs that you've designed in your own house?
That I have designed in my house. You know what? I don't tend to keep those things. Sometimes I do things very quickly, and they.
Well, you know,
Eames
chairs in his Eames house.
No, of course, the chairs that I have done and they're in production. Yes, I have it, and I have it in my house, and I have it in my office.
Do you enjoy that?
I think it's good, but I'm looking what's next.
But a lot of your product is corporate type.
It's very it's contract furniture, so it's not as, you know, the aesthetic is the function takes precedent over the aesthetic. However, the aesthetic is not forgotten.
Well, for my own experience, I have to say that when anybody comes to my house, I have a little house in Connecticut, and my freedom chair lives there. Mm-hmm. And whenever anyone comes over, I can't keep them out of it. Mm-hmm. They just settle into it and recline and put their feet up on a thrift store chair that I have that's at perfect height as a hassock. And it's like a throne.
Yeah, it is an engineering marvel, I have to say. I think it's lean. and it works perfectly.
But on the other hand, it's so aggressively modern looking that the space in which it lives has had to take on a kind of a high tech, a post-industrial look, so that it's not out of place. It's mm-hmm. not a chair, even though it's one of the most comfortable chairs ever made, mm-hmm. that you would put in the living room. Unless your living room is
an office.
An office, yeah. Unless so there is an appropriateness. Or what I mean to say is that within object design, there are themes that we take almost as a received understanding of this is an office object, this is a living room object, this is a bedroom object. And I think that is part and parcel with our culture. To get back to what we were talking about before, the notion that design taste could be universal, I'm not so sure.
I don't think so either.
I'm not so sure. Even though the Chinese seem to like, and it was back to what you were saying, Mike, that perhaps electronics translates more readily across different cultures.
Well, there's also, you know, there's this growing, small but growing field that has to do with design and the brain, or design and, you know, neurology, if that's the right word. You know, we are in some way hardwired to react.
To find certain, shapes pleasant.
Yeah, yeah. So shapes and colors. So I have to believe that plays a role in some of this. We were made to react to certain things in certain ways.
Do you think that's hereditary? I mean, there are studies of babies, like infants, reacting to something that's conventionally pleasing to the eye and versus not.
I can't imagine it's hereditary, but I don't really know what I'm talking about.
Oh, you know, B.F. Skinner put one of his children in a box so that all of the sensory experiences of that child were strictly controlled and limited, just to see how the development of that child differed from his other children. And it was a disaster. The kid was crying the whole time. Daddy, mommy, hold me. But that is held to be a constant. Certainly, if you look at feng shui theory, the deep theory, you'll find that they have codified color selections as having certain aspects that deal with the elements and the flow of qi that over 30 or 40 years as a designer you would probably come upon yourself. To what extent, Manuel, does color play a role in what you design?
Well, I think it's a big, functionally and aesthetically, I think color is a big player. Just to indicate things, functionally, just to indicate things, so what's hot, what's not, just to give clues to the user, where to grab it, etc., just to give more of an understanding at just a plain sight. And then aesthetically, I think it can make or break a product. If you have too much or too little or no color or not the right colors, it might be beautiful, it might work well, but it's just not.
And, you know, that reminds me of something you were talking about earlier, Mike, about if you go back and look at the shelter magazines of a couple of years ago or so and look at those products again, what occurs to me is the prodigious output of Philippe Starck. And 10, 15 years ago, everyone was saying, wow, you know, it was mm-hmm. great. Like Stark's ghost chair, which is mm-hmm. clear plastic. And I look at that now and I say, wow, that's boring.
But you got used to it, yes?
You know, I never really got used to them. I don't like the idea of sitting on a crystal
ghost.
Clear chair. I like my chairs to have a certain amount of substance. Similarly, I don't like to eat on plates that are souvenirs. There's a
that's a Good analogy.
There's a really great line from a Sam Shepard play where there's two brothers and they're lost in the desert together, and it's like Cain and Abel, and the one brother is saying, "When I'm eating my mashed potatoes, I don't want to see Idaho peeking through." apropos of nothing. I think a lot of
So what happened? Did the culture change, or you changed, or you just never liked them? What happened there?
That, with Stark stuff? Yeah, I never really much liked the bullhorn as a design motif. It always made me cringe. Perhaps that was the intention. I see a bull's horn turned into a lamp, and all I can think of is the running of the bulls in Spain and people being gored. But that does not make me happy.
But what do you think, and this is something that I think about sometimes, those products to me, and some of Philippe's products, some other products that are done by star designers, most of the time are just done to push things forward, not just to actually perform as the lamp, but it's just to make people think and make other tiny question the status quo to drive things forward a little bit more.
A lamp as a lamp as a lamp, it's just in a different
form. If I needed a lamp to read, I would not buy the lamp. However, if I want to impress people when I have it in my house, or I want to be seen as a forward-looking person back in the 80s or 90s, whenever the lamp was on, maybe it makes sense to have it in my house.
Well, you think about events like the Milan Furniture Fair or ICFF here in New York, where, if you go to the Milan Furniture Fair, which is the premier design event in the world, right? You've been there many times. The miles upon miles upon miles of cubicles with design in them. And I think part of what we're talking about is the pressure to distinguish yourself from what the designers in the next cubicle over are doing, right? You have to have a kind of wow factor or shock factor in this design to stand
remember
out.
Remember
right?
that in that scenario, being shocking is the commodity. out of that context, yes, it might be a shocking thing. So you even need to go beyond the shocking. What is that? I think that's probably what people are thinking about.
And shock value so often is mistaken for design brilliance.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think that, I think Manuel's hitting on something that.
Shock value to sell something. That's one aspect, and that's an important part of your business. But something that's shocking for the sake of drawing attention doesn't mean that it's good design.
No, not at all. And to me, one of the things that I see most of the time is the media, the effect of the media on those particular designs. And I think the media, sometimes they don't...
Can you think of a particularly shocking design that comes to mind?
The interiors for, I think it's Mondrian Hotel, so I'm not sure which hotel that Marcel Wanders did. Or even the hotels that Philippe Starck did.
Like the Royalton, for example.
They are shocking. You feel. They make you feel.
Unfortunately, if you're coming to New York to check out the Royalton Hotel, the Stark interior has been demolished and been replaced by a totally banal, dark S&M pit with a lot of leather and bronze.
But what I was saying is there's really, I don't know how much design value and aesthetic and function that they're bringing in. However, they're making you feel things, and they're bringing a new perspective on things. So a few years back, you saw Marcel Wanders doing a lot of patterns, a lot of floral motifs. Yeah, and then you start seeing things happening on other products.
So patterns.
With floral patterns, motifs, and things that I see them, and I say, okay, I see what the roots of this is.
Sure.
And I applaud. I think it's good.
In some ways, it's parallel to the fashion industry.
I think it is,
But I would say only to the extent that these objects and products are considered to be disposable. I think perhaps if things were not as disposable, there would be more design constancy and less wow shock factor.
What about, now, for example, the Chinese stadium, the Nest?
The Nest.
To me, it's a beautiful execution. It's a very nice
design. You know, at first I hated it. But the more that I looked I have not been to Beijing, but the more that I looked at photographs of its execution and of its lighting design, the more I came to love it.
I think it's nice.
And now, to me, it's a beautiful, magnificent, huge version of a Chinese bird nest soup.
Why does that come to mind as an example?
Because, to me, that was a trigger to many other designs that brought that mesh, the intricate design of the Burlesque Brothers. They have a chair that looks just like it.
Yes.
And so on. We have several... to me, I think those are the great things. Even with cars, cars also bring some sort of that edge. Mm-hmm. Back in 2000, there was a car, I think it was a Pontiac Spyder, that had a lot of edges. Uh-huh. It was very sharp, crisp lines. Suddenly, all consumer electronics look like that 2 or 3 years later. So it depends where things get picked from.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, I mean, I think that the design... A lot of what we're talking about may be applied to the old world of design, the pre-financial crash world of design. Yes, of course, people are still going to be showing things at the Milan Furniture Fair, and there will be the same viral effect that we're talking about. But I do think that the design conversation has shifted a little bit from the consumer orientation of design to something else.
Let's take a little break, a little musical break, gentlemen. And when we come back, we'll talk about the new, and perhaps we'll even indulge in a little trash talking about designs that we really hate, because that always plays well.
All the glowing sun, drawings that shine from the coast built on projection.
We are burning down the house. It's still burning. Oh my God. Don't put it out. Feed the flames. Alere flamas. Every Thursday at heritageradionetwork.com. Brought to you by TechServe, the number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer. Our guests are Manuel Saez, Michael Cannell, and guest interlocutor Jamie Wow. Right before the break, Mike, you were saying that you think that a new ethos is going to come out of the second Great Depression.
I do, yeah. I mean, you know, it was sort of prescient, but you know, the Cooper Hewitt here in New York.
Oh, that's on our official "We Love to Hate It" list.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I'm gonna love it for a second here because they had a show called "Design for the Other 90%," which was what?
Oh, wait. I'm talking about 41 Cooper Square. You're talking about
I'm talking about the Cooper Hewitt, okay. The Design Museum.
Yes.
And they had a show called "Design for the Other 90%," which was all about how. Oh, really, only 10% of the world's population benefits from the services of designers, and 90% of the world's population does not. And I think we're kind of in a moment now when the design conversation has shifted towards design as a way of solving problems, design in service to infrastructure, design in service to communicating information, and not so much design
as an
being about
of personal ego.
Yeah, and feathering one's nest.
I have a question for you about that, though. It was recently brought to my attention. I was talking about that show to someone the other day, and I was talking about there's one project that was done in Africa where you were all worried about the quality and accessibility of water in Africa, and there was one project whereby basically a design firm would build a merry-go-round for children, and the children would play on the merry-go-round. That would be the energy source for a well to bring, like, the bucket down into the well to bring up the water so that then the community could have clean water. And the money for this was funded by a given private company that would put up a billboard. And so it was a self-sustained way of funding clean water.
How gross.
Very clever.
A billboard. I mean, what was wrong with just knowing that they'd funded a human-powered fun?
And who would be the market?
Generator.
Well,
yeah.
Perhaps.
And what are they going to buy? You know, they don't have any money.
Yeah.
Well, I think at the end of the day, it was photographed a lot. And let's give them a little bit of credit. You know,
Brought to you by Texaco.
Exactly.
McDonald's.
But we have a lot of people doing, you know, in these individual projects like this in areas of need. But there's not an infrastructure connecting all of this. And so you might, at the end of the day, if you don't have a macro solution, if you only have a bunch of micro solutions, maybe you have a well here, a well there, a well there.
What's wrong with that? It's grassroots work.
Well, for sure, but you have a well here, a well there, a well there. And you start to have conflicts between the communities about their different wells rather than having a macro solution, which is actually a plumbing solution to plumbing on a society level rather than a bunch of different, let's just call it.
Yeah, but you're favoring a Bucky Fuller one world Dymaxian solution to spaceship Earth, and that always went with one world government. So I don't know how reasonable that
is. From my point of view, I'm prepared to believe that, you know, a lot of those things don't work, or that there may be somewhere in there somebody may have some kind of insidious personal motivation. I think what's significant in terms of the culture of design, though, mm-hmm. is that people have shifted away from the kind of stuff that offended your mother in the magazine to talking about. I bet you anything, if tonight we went to the studio up at Columbia University, the young designers there would all, like, their heroes are not Philippe Starck now.
Right.
Their heroes are people like, you know, the people at Architecture for Humanity.
Exactly. And in Williamsburg, too. You know, the biggest current right now is reclaimed wood. It's not something that's fabulous. Basically, there's a difference between something that makes you feel 80s and 90s style that makes you feel like, okay, so you look at someone driving something or wearing something and you think, oh my gosh, that looks expensive, and that's the first thought that comes into your head, and that has gone away in appeal, and now you know we all want to look at something and instead of saying
you think that's gone away.
I do.
I mean, I was standing on the street smoking a cigarette and a Maybach drove by, and I looked at the people in there, I thought, wow, that's like a that's like driving around in an airship. There's so much space in there. Yeah, that must be fun.
No, but I think now people, the currency now is something that's interesting, something that's sentimental. I think that's one reason for the big vintage movement right now. People are wanting to curate their own sense of style rather than, you know, see a prestige piece like a Rolex watch or a Mercedes car. Instead, they think, oh, I want a Mercedes car, but I want it to cost $3,000 and be like a bunch of nails and whatever and have 200,000 miles on it and be from 1960 rather than something.
Well, the really interesting question is this just yet another kind of fashion iteration?
Mm-hmm.
Will the, you know, pendulum of fashion swing back the other way any moment?
Right.
Or is this actually like a seismic change for design, you know, at least for a generation? Will this be a long-standing change of orientation?
I think it remains to be seen what kind of capital returns to the market.
I think you hit it on the point. I think design by itself, it's not going to go far other than just a good intention or just a good thought. And even maybe a good execution to a level. But if there's not a good team up with the industry or whoever is going to be actually making a profit out of this, and I'm talking about all these humanitarian projects, I think there's also an opportunity to make a profit when you do good things. And I think that's what design is to look into, thinking about how can you use design power in order to team up with the business, make everybody happy. And that is, it's really taking the design initiative, not just to create a product, but also to create the whole solution.
So how do you feel about Target, the discount store that has some nicely designed things, without getting into specifics of Michael Graves' design idiosyncrasies?
You know, I think all the big box store, not just Target, I think they have they need to meet their quarterly goals or whatever their budget or the specific goals for that quarter are, and that drives everything. So they might tell me, yes, you are design driven, but I don't think that is really what makes the decisions, with the reason behind all the decisions. So if you were looking at Target to be a design-driven, it might be a little bit better than Walmart, yet it's still the same as Walmart.
It's the same business model.
It's
yes.
just the same
I
thing.
I mean, when you walk down the aisles of Target, do you feel like it's design-driven? I mean, I don't.
I don't. I feel like I'm in a zoo.
Not particularly. Yeah.
I mean, I wonder if that's an idea that was just sort of...
But I have, I have selective vision. There's a lot of stuff I just don't see because it hurts too much.
I think the point to me, the big stores, and I'm including Home Depot and including CVS and every big store that is a chain, they have forgotten about the user. They have forgotten about the experience of going by into the stores, which to me is a bigger thing. I don't mind paying more and going to Whole Foods and buy something and I feel good about it.
Maybe you like the presentation better?
I think it's I don't know, it's just the drive that the people that work at the store, there's no trash on the floor, things are what they should be, basic stuff.
So if someone being friendly and greeting you at the door at Walmart doesn't, that's not enough for you?
I'm not sure that
me personally, I'd rather not be greeted, actually.
But this is the thing, that is a job. It's not what they want to be doing.
Yeah, okay. It's not like they're hanging out being
they
friendly.
They have to do that. It's not that they want to do that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And ideally, if you're working in a store and me running a store or me being somebody trying to create that feeling in the store, I will make sure that people feel that, not they have to greet somebody and be helpful and tell you where things are.
Does this attitude come over into your design concepts?
My take is, I think... and I wrote something on Fast Company about this, but the designer needs to accommodate for this. So as I design a product, and I know it's going to be sold in a big box store, I need to accommodate for no explanations being given, no parts to be attached to, or no second piece to be bought on the side in order to complete my product. I need to think about all that because I need to assume that nobody's going to be there, parts are going to be... not in the same place, etc. So
if there's if it's an electrical device, it should be very clear where the on-off button is,
what,
for example.
What does it do? Why is it good? and how much it is, and all the valuable things need to be communicated in the first 2 seconds that you see it.
Ah.
So it's in the products and the packaging is everything.
Oh, packaging, however, has words on it, you know, which explain.
Yeah, but I think with a good, clever design, you might not need packaging, which is another big step forward, too.
I can't even imagine how we do this, but that's food for further thought. We only have a few minutes left. Aside from a reassessment of this second age of greed, or third or fourth, here in America, we've had many, many ages of greed. Our most recent one has come crashing down around us. Do you see any interesting new trends that we should watch? Certainly the reclaimed materials movement is very popular here in Brooklyn and in New York because people in Brooklyn tend to be poor and like to scavenge. Roberta's Restaurant, our host here, is full of scavenged materials, which gives it an instant authenticity because the materials are gently aged over years and years of use and then nicely repurposed, which is something that would cost a lot of money to replicate using virgin timber, just for example. Do you see any sort of trends with higher technology, Manuel? Fiber-reinforced plastic structures, high tensile steel.
What I see, especially in things that are manufactured in mass, there's a tendency of saying or using a marketing pitch in order to say things that are what people want to hear, but really not making sense from the manufacturing point of view.
What do people want? Oh, people want to hear about green these days.
The bamboo, for example.
Yes.
So people go out of the way to have bamboo in their products. Yet bamboo might not be the most environmentally friendly material for that purpose. Getting the bamboo to that finish might cost...
Oh, true, so true. Bamboo flooring in a house is mostly resin. There's a little bit of bamboo in
there's
there.
There's a lot of formaldehyde.
But the rest is...
pretty bad thing, actually.
Heavy chemistry. Exactly. Correct.
However, you can do that well, but I think when you do that you, it becomes in a different price range. Really, what the bamboo that we get here is from China. We really don't know how they make it. Million things. However, the bamboo word sounds good.
And it had to be shipped all the way across the Pacific Ocean or air freighted, which is expensive. And
even just go to Bath, Bath & Beyond stores, you see brushes with bamboo handles.
Right.
And is that really making sense or not? I mean,
and woven bamboo fabrics, which is crazy. I mean, to get bamboo that soft.
Clothing.
The chemicals that would have had to been used are probably pretty toxic. So we have about 2 minutes left. Do you have any parting words or direction for our listeners?
Well, just one thought. You used the word authenticity, and I think authenticity is going to be, or already is, a kind of a key word for a directional word for design. You know, it's interesting to note that when the stock market plummeted last fall, the website Etsy was booming, breaking records. And Etsy, for those who don't know it, is a website where you can buy furniture and other products, all handmade directly from the craftsmen and designers. So I think we're living in a moment when people want to surround themselves with design that they associate with an individual rather than a corporation. And they want to know the backstory. You know, they want to know its provenance. We were joking before we went on the air tonight about how design follows food, but this is actually a case where it's true. You know, people want to buy food at the farmer's market, and I think we're beginning to see now the design equivalent of that. People want to buy design from the design equivalent of the farmer's market.
And that's exactly the reason that we have this program. which is to raise the level of discourse about design so that people who are interested, the way that people are interested about food, how does it come to your grocery store and how do you best cook it, which is part of the stream of consciousness that we speak about here at Heritage Radio Network. Here we want to talk about design ideas. Where did they come from and where are we going? Our guests today have been Jamie Amoua, Manuel Saez, Michael Cannell, and we've been sponsored by TechServe, the number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer. Our hour went too quickly. We'll have to reconvene and talk trash. Never got around to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk to you next time.